9. Johnny quietly and efficiently neatened up his scene. In case anything happened to him, which he felt was more than likely in this American raid, he carefully briefed Angus in all the intricacies of the console. He made copious notes, especially for Angus, so that he could duplicate and operate such a console. He told him some of the things that could be done with it. Angus objected violently to Johnny's going on the raid. Johnny said he was not going to risk anyone else's life, for the actions he had to take were too dicey. He would have the backup of 30 Scots, 10 drivers, and 15 pilots. Angus was still trying to protest, but it didn't do any good. If Robert the Fox had been there, the two of them might have prevailed. But Sir Robert was over in America moving the academy, and Angus gave in reluctantly. A Scot aide of Sir Robert's was there, and Johnny briefed him on the military aspects of their situation. The visitors were waiting for something. He was not sure what. Johnny felt it had to do with whether or not they got a transshipment rig operating. An analysis of their chatter among themselves showed they were observing the American compound, waiting for something to happen. The visitors had seen cyclos there, probably Turl and Care, and seemed to think the American scene might still be in cyclo hands, or in any event, might be political. Johnny expected the sky to fall in right after that transshipment rig was fired, and an alert should be out, then, for Day 92, which was approaching very quickly. Johnny briefed another Scot officer and arranged a decoy platform to be hastily built in the Singapore area. There was a mine site there, northwest of the ancient, deserted Man City, where the cyclos had mined tin, titanium, and tungsten. It had full hydroelectric power, atmosphere armor, and a certain amount of stores and planes left in it. A handful of Chinese, 3 pilots, a communicator, a coordinator, and this officer were to play out a platform and poles. Johnny gave them the old burned-out console, which they repainted. Under the protection of the cable, they were to make like they were busy firing, complete with things appearing and disappearing on the platform. When the flights left the American area with the real console, the heaviest part of the escort would streak to the Singapore area and pull any pursuit of the real console away. The Kariba platform had been under camouflage nets from the beginning, and chatter from the visitors showed they thought it was a temple. He warned the officer that the attack would be heavy there in the Singapore area, but the Scot just smiled and grabbed his allocated men and left. Johnny made a fast tour of Kariba. The Chinese had done wonderfully well. There was a roof under the screen, but over the firing platform, all held together with wooden pegs. Swooping gables and points made it very artistic. They had a lot of dragons around, carved from wood and cast in clay, that pointed out from the beam ends with flaming mouths and scaly tails. They had bunkers inside the protected cone. They all had tiled interiors. They even had a little hospital. Their own village was inside the protective cable over by the lakeshore. It was all very colorful and attractive, more like a garden than a war area. Dr. Allen had gotten some juice of plants from up in the old Nairobi area, he called it pyrethrum, that killed insects very efficiently. And despite the number of animals in the woods thereabouts that attracted flies, they had had no trouble with tsetse sleeping sickness. Johnny heard them singing and playing on strange string and wind instruments that evening, so he recorded a lot of it and had them rig loudspeakers ready to play it when they activated the area. It would foul up any listening beams from upstairs. That, plus the interference the armor cable posed, would keep them ignorant of what was going on here. When he returned to the African compound, it was Day 87. He found Stormalong there with more disks that showed the color codes of the cables and the pole wires. They could simply hack off the console's cables and reconnect them at Kariba. He gave the code to Angus. Stormalong said this would be his last run, so Johnny briefed him carefully on the military situation. It was Johnny's belief that the visitors would attack in force after any American firing. Stormalong had better be prepared to take control of air defenses on the planet. Johnny would not let him go on the raid. Donald Dean was handling air cover for them on that. Thor would be with them in the raiding party. Johnny missed Robert the Fox, who usually handled these briefings and actions. Stormalong, like Angus, did not want Johnny to go. He said America was stripped now. The academy was empty. Johnny would have only his own raiding party, and though he knew it had been drilled within an inch of the participants' lives, there were an awful lot of Brigantes over there. Just after they had pulled the recorders out of the three places at the academy, Brigantes had begun to systematically loot the place. But with no Sir Robert to support his objections, Stormalong did not prevail. Johnny was going up to an upper level of the compound, and he ran into Care. The Cyclo Midget was all smiles. They swatted paws. He had been looking for Johnny to show him the silly money they were now printing for America, and in which he had been paid. Johnny pulled him into a deserted office and shook his head over the 100-credit note and the picture of Brown Limper Staffer.
"The stuff is worthless," said Care. "The Brigantes just throw it into the street."
Care was so happy to be out of that area. He told Johnny all about it.
"And he offered me 750,000 galactic credits that I'll never see. He's one crazy cyclo, not sane like us half-humans."
Care laughed over that. Care gave him the final layouts of the firing platform area. There was nothing new. Care had dug and done exactly according to plan. It was the same plan on which his raiding team had been drilled, and Care assured him everything was in place. But Care hadn't realized Johnny was going over there. When he heard that, he got very serious.
"This churl is a very bad one. He's liable to have surprises. I don't like your going, Johnny."
Johnny said he had to go.
"What if you get a Cyclo War Party back on that platform and return?" said Care.
"I don't think we will," said Johnny. "And we have a present for Cyclo."
"I hope so," said Care. "It's my furry neck if they ever turn up here again. The IBI would take days to kill me."
"I don't think you have anything to worry about," said Johnny. "But you stay here among these defenses. There's quite a few enemy prisoners in the place and all the cyclos that are left. Maybe you can teach them to play cards." Care laughed, and then he said,
"Did the one you call Sir Robert come back here?"
"Why?"
"Well, right in the middle of the academy move to England, we didn't see him anymore. I wanted to check a couple of points with him, and I couldn't find him. And Dunaldine put in calls. He isn't in Edinburgh or Luxembourg or Russia. I thought he must be here. The reason I ask is he knows all your dispositions of forces and even some of your raid details."
Johnny was very concerned about Sir Robert. He threw off Care's question with, "They could never make him talk."
"The IBI could make anybody talk," said Care.
"We don't know the enemy has him," said Johnny. Shortly afterward, he instituted his own queries. There was no sign of Sir Robert in any area. A couple of ferry planes had gone down lately from enemy attack. They had been en route from America to Scotland. Had Sir Robert been on one of them? Sir Robert had not handled many of the details of this raid. There was no reason to change planning this late. Johnny spent his last day at the Lake Victoria mine site, neatening up what there was of his personal life. He was under no illusion that this raid was not dangerous. He wrote a letter to Chrissy that he knew the parson would read for her, and put it in plain sight on his desk, the envelope marked, "To Chrissy in case of something happening to me." He had heard one wrote wills to leave personal possessions. He started one. All he had was his horses and some odds and ends of clothes. He couldn't think of anything else he owned. Then he thought maybe Chrissy had occupied the Edinburgh house in his name, so he put down any interest he had in that or its contents and left it to Chrissy. Then he remembered he had a few books, so he left those to Patty. For the life of him, he couldn't recall anything else he owned. But maybe people would think he owned gifts like the chrome AK-47. They weren't very many. Still, they might be. So he added a clause, "And anything else I am found to own shall be equally divided among..." And he listed the names of those men who had been closest to him. He thought for a while and then added Care. He had also heard that you signed these things and got them witnessed, so he did that. Then he put it in an envelope and put it alongside the letter to Chrissy. Feeling he had made things very orderly, he spent that evening making sure all his weapons and gear worked, that his radiation suit had no holes in it, that his air mask tanks were full, and that half a dozen kill clubs were in throwing condition. He put copies of the latest sales contract Turl had signed into his pouch. He checked the beryllium bomb case for safe carrying. He tested the edge of a hatchet to cut console cables. He felt he was ready and got a good sleep on his last night before the American raid. He had done everything he could. Now it was in the hands of the gods, or a devil like Turl. Chapter 24 1 At the American mine site, day 92 had dawned windy and cold, and then in mid-morning, 4 hours before firing time, it had begun to snow. It was not too late for snow, but this snow was a heavy one. It came down in huge, soft flakes that swirled here and there in the wind puffs. Turl didn't care. He was jubilant. This would be his last day on Earth. So far, things had gone smoothly. From sunup to the moment it started to snow, he had been outside, checking the wiring and cables. Almost lovingly, he had put a final polish on the firing points on the poles, the points which would change space and transport him once again to his homeland. He had a wonderful story all made up. He would come in with the tale of a mutiny, of a sellout to an alien race, and how he, Turl, fighting hard, had saved the company technology and was forced, alas, to use the ultimate bomb to make certain the company was not further betrayed. They would believe him on Cyclo. They would, of course, fire a camera back and check, but it would record a black smudge. Then he would retire, saying that the strain of it all had been too much. And one fine night he would go to a cemetery and do a bit of quiet digging, and become richer by 10 gold coffin lids and 2 billion credits that he would expose bit by bit, saying he had profited on the exchanges of the various universes. It was a perfect plan. He had been idling about for a few minutes, wondering when the Briganti Special Squad would come down from the mountains. He didn't like to stay outside. He hated this planet too much. But today, the breathe gas didn't seem to make him ill, and after all, it was a great day. And here they were, the Brigante Special Squad. They had their bundle with them just as ordered. It was long and made to look like baggage. Just before the firing, Turl would open the end of it, and one of Smith's bodyguards would pop an air mask on it, and anybody seeing it would think twice about charging the platform. He told the Special Squad to just dump it on the middle of the platform and then stand by. Now for the next step. Turl went back into the compound and got the small forklift he had had parked there in the corridor, got on it, and went into his office. It was really a toss-up whether he took the coffins first or the console. The coffins could stand the weather better. With a Brigante squad there, nobody could come up and steal them. They were too heavy. He paused for a moment, looking at his rug. There was a dust tread mark there. But then he thought he must have made it himself. His X mark was there on each coffin. With 4 rapid runs and very expert machine handling, he got the 4 coffins outside and dumped them on the platform. 4 trips. On each trip, he cautioned the squad to be alert and watch them. Now for the console. He tipped it up on edge to get at the hollow bottom. He unlocked a cabinet and got the booby trap and put it under the front edge of the bottom. He would not set it yet. He would give it 10 minutes from when he operated the console at firing time. The length of the firing would be 3 minutes. He had decided to take it easy on himself, and the recoil time would be about 40 seconds later. So 6 minutes and 20 seconds after he fired, bang, no console. He took it out and put it down on the oversized metal platform made for it, a platform about 10 feet by 7 feet, just inside the atmosphere armor zone. All nicely figured out. The big bus bars, which operated the atmosphere armor cable, had long since been installed on a raised board. He hadn't expected snow, but he had put a weather shield on the cable board. He hadn't put a shelter for the console itself, so now he had to throw a piece of tarpaulin over it to keep snow off the buttons. Turl adjusted the console's position and then got the forklift out of there. He simply dumped it. What did it matter? Those animals had left machinery all over the place. Big magnetic cranes, blade scrapers, diggers. What a mess. He got busy connecting the power cables from the poles to the console. It was quite a massive lot of cables. He didn't want to trip on his way from the console when he punched in the coordinates to the platform, so he bundled them all together. It made a snake about 6 inches in diameter. Turl double-checked the color codes. Yes, he had them all correct. He checked the armor cable by turning it on. A lot of new snow flew into the air in a circle. Yes, it worked. He turned it off. He checked the juice input to the console. All live. Turl looked at his watch. It was a full hour to firing time. Time to go in for a mouthful of Kerbango. He surveyed the office. Last time he would ever see this place. Thank the devils. Turl opened his cabinets and began to dump anything and everything into the recycling bin. He opened the false backs and bottoms and consigned anything in them to oblivion. The habits of a security chief were too strong. He dumped all his reams of notes and formulas into the maw of the recycler. Then he noticed it wasn't running. Ah, of course. He must have blown the compound fuses when he put that armor cable on. Who cared? This planet was going up in smoke anyway. He went to his closet and got his dress uniform and boots out and quickly changed. He put on his parade cap. He looked at himself in the mirror. Pretty good. Turl threw a few things in a travel bag. He looked at his watch. 20 minutes to go. The snow, he could see through the compound roof, was coming down even heavier. Who cared?